Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Technology has disrupted nearly every field of endeavor in the 21st century, but despite many proponents saying that technology can transform education, as the pandemic is providing a massive experiment in technological learning via distance learning, most parents and students are wanting, even demanding, that children go back to the traditional classroom. Well, my guest today examines why technology has not disrupted education in the same way it has retail, office work, or skilled labor. Justin Reich is a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. He is the host of the podcast Teach Lab and has written about education and technology for Education Week, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Justin Reich, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Yeah, because of the pandemic, right now we've been forced to embark on a major, massive experiment in K through 12 education, moving to distance learning or hybrid formats in some places. Do you think out of that we will find a new way to educate, or will this be in some ways a lost year for students?
I think neither of those will happen. I'm hoping that we don't have an entirely lost year, and I also don't think we're going to have profoundly different changes. I think the most likely circumstance is that as soon as we can make our schools and communities safe, we're going to snap back to something that looks more like status quo anti-pandemic. I think we'll find that through these digital experiments, there was a lot of frustration, but there was some learning that happened. I think we're going to have a generation of students that is more familiar with online learning, that has developed some skills and habits around independent, self-regulated learning. There are definitely some things that are not being taught effectively during this period. I think the third graders, you know, this spring and this fall are not learning as much third grade math as happened in 2017 or 2018. But, you know, we're always learning, and I think students are learning an awful lot about learning through technology, self-regulated learning, other kinds of things like that. So even as we have concerns about learning loss and what we miss, it's also important to celebrate the good work and the innovative learning that students and teachers are doing during this tough period.
So do you suppose that some of the necessities of distance learning will find their way into a post-COVID classroom?
I think so. I think that there will be a minority of students in all different kinds of contexts who say to themselves, this is great. One of the things I've been saying is that everyone is having a different pandemic. If you had a lot of social anxieties in school, if you thought that school was really constraining and didn't like that feeling of always being told what to do and where to go, if you're in a school system in which you're a minority and you experience forms of racism or bigotry, then being at home and learning at home can be great. It can feel healthy and empowering, and I think a small group of people will feel that way. I think the majority of learners will have learned some useful new skills. I think some teachers are going to have new tricks up their sleeve that they bring back to traditional classrooms. And these kinds of interruptions to schooling are going to become more common in the decades ahead. As climate change reshapes our planet, there's going to be more pandemics, there's going to be more fires, there's going to be more flooding, there's going to be more interrupted schooling. And so, sadly, I think some of the things that we're learning during this period are going to be lessons that many school systems around the United States will have to continue to practice in the years ahead.
Well, let me ask you about that first group of students you were talking about, the ones that were maybe finding learning at home to be an enlightening way of learning and without all the stresses of a school situation that they feel like a square peg in a round hole. Will schools be flexible enough to find new solutions for those students?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure. You know, we do have, in almost every state in the country, existing fully virtual school options. One problem with them is that historically they've provided really poor educational resources, services, products, experiences to their students. There's lots of evidence that on average, students who go to these schools perform less well on standardized tests, not only for the year that they're enrolled, but in some cases for years following. But there have always been students who attend these schools, particularly like, you know, athletes or gymnasts or actresses or artists or just people who want to do something that looks more like homeschooling, but is not quite as unstructured as family-led homeschooling, that have taken good advantage of these resources. And, you know, and probably the one exception to that might be the Florida state system, which has a state virtual school, the Florida Virtual Schools, which has done a really interesting job of not only providing fully virtual experiences, but also virtual experiences for individual courses, which is particularly important, I think, in rural areas. You know, there are lots of rural schools in the country that can't offer a full range of all of the language classes we might like students to learn, or all of the advanced options we might like students to learn, or, you know, electives in, you know, sort of, you know, computer arts, digital media, other things like that. And my sense is that school systems will incrementally over time continue to offer more of these kinds of options to their students, you know, not in a way that I think, you know, completely changes or unbundles, you know, the high school experience for students, but in a way that just makes it a little bit more likely and more normal that instead of taking five courses in person, you know, you might take four courses in person and one online, and then there'll probably be a couple more kids who, you know, do their sports at school, do arts at school, have lunch at school, and do a lot of their online classes, do a lot of their academic classes online.
And, of course, that socialization is also really important.
It's not only important, but it is core to the motivation of why kids go to school. You know, there's a lot in school that can be very frustrating and very boring for students. If we survey students about their experiences at school, boredom is one of the words that comes up most frequently. There's all kinds of things that we could and should be doing to giving teachers more support to be able to create richer, more engaging learning environments and so forth. But one of the reasons why people go to school is because of the relationships they have with their peers and their teachers. And many of those relationships are developed not just through they happen through the debate team, they happen because you get put into groups in class, but so many of them happen in these little interstitial moments which appear in school but aren't planned for. They happen in passing time when you linger at a teacher's desk for a few minutes afterwards, or when, you know, class, the activities run out, you know, everybody finishes what they're supposed to be doing after 32 minutes instead of 47 minutes. And every once in a while the teacher says, well, let's just hang out and talk about stuff. And those are some of the moments that we're losing during remote schooling. And the challenge is that they kind of happen naturally in school, but if we want them to happen in remote school, we have to plan for them and we have to design for them. We did a bunch of focus groups with educators, with students, with parents and family members, and when we talked to students about this year coming up ahead, some of the things that they were most concerned about were, how are we going to connect with our peers? How are we going to do fun stuff with them? And then they also said that, you know, one of the things most important to them in school was this feeling that they got to know adults, that they built relationships with people who they felt like had their back. And how was that going to happen in the beginning of a new school year remotely?
Yeah, that mentor relationship, or maybe it's not even as formal as a mentor. It's an adult looking at that student in a different way than a parent or a parent of a friend.
Yeah, I love that phrase, looking at. This is something I've been thinking about a lot. So much of what we do in schools is we watch and we are watched. And think about in the classroom, I bet most listeners can think back to a moment where a teacher was looking at you in a way where that really helped connect. You were having a hard time one day, and a teacher looked at you with a certain kind of sympathy, or you really figured something out, and you saw that like big smile flash across the face of your teacher, and that, you know, created a relationship, motivates you to learn. So much of that watching can't happen through the distance communication technologies that we have, or if it does happen, it happens really differently. We don't see each other, even when our faces, you know, technically appear in video conferencing software, we still don't see and be seen in the same way. And, you know, one of the kind of amazing things that we're learning right now is that there, you know, there's so much that happens in school that we take for granted. When we did these focus groups with students, one of them said something like, I wish there was a button that I could press and a teacher would just appear and help me with what I want. And here's the thing about schools. We don't use a button, but there basically is like a universal help signal, which is raising your hand. If you're an adolescent, you can be just about anywhere on school property. And if you hold up your hand, in a minute or two, some caring adult is going to come up to you and help address the issue that you have. You can do it in the hallway. You can do it in your classroom. You can do it in the study hall. You can do it in the lunchroom. There's this sort of universal beacon for help, which really works remarkably well, that we don't think about. It's, you know, it's just sort of, it's the air we breathe in schools. But I think we've taken for granted that immediacy. And so there are school systems that are developing creative solutions to the press a button to summon a teacher, whether that's assigning every student an advisor or having a text message line or a video conference room, which is sort of staffed with someone to help you. Mm-hmm. But that immediate, you know, that immediacy is like one example of a thing that we take for granted in schools, which turns out to actually be enormously important, even if we don't work at it that much, and very hard to replicate online.
My guest today is Justin Reich. He's a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. It's published by Harvard University Press. We've been living this experiment, and it sounds like, from what you're saying, that what we're finding is, yes, we're seeing technology that can perhaps aid in the classroom, but there's a reason why this traditional classroom has existed for 100 years and been fairly resistant to change over that time. It's because there's things about it that work pretty well for everybody.
Yeah, there are lots of things that work about it really well. The other thing is that what we want schools to do is just in some respects unfathomably complex. Think about all of the things that we've asked school systems to do. We've asked them to feed children. We've asked them to provide a safe place for them to learn. We asked them to teach kids how to tie their shoes, how to conjugate verbs, how to factor polynomials, how to not have sex, but if you are going to have sex, how to do it in certain ways, how to be a patriot, how to question your country, how to participate in government, how to obey rules. The list of things that we want schools to do just goes on and on and on, and we don't agree about what those things are. We have political debates about the boundaries of those goals, but basically schools take those complex requests of society, those political debates, and they manage it into a kind of very delicate balance where they come up with some way the data scientists at MIT would say, you know, optimizing the objective function, taking all those little pieces and saying, this is maybe the best place to sit. So then, you know, over the last two decades, education technologists have come along and they've said, look at every other sector of society. Look at journalism. Look at our relationships. Look at retail. Education, like all of these other sectors, is ripe for disruption and transformation. And new technologies are going to come along, and they're going to sweep away the past because they are so much better than what we can offer right now. And over the last two decades, you know, folks have made these arguments about K-12 schools, about adaptive tutors, about massive open online courses, and we haven't yet seen profound change. And I think, to me, the most striking thing during a pandemic is that the arguments of education technologists were, in some ways, we can do better than the existing system. Well, since March of 2020, the existing system has been hobbled. The existing system is collapsing under the weight of the pandemic and society's constraints. And all of these new technologies are still not sort of winning the day or carrying the argument. There are very few places where folks are saying, why aren't we using these brand new tools to reconfigure education? Most of what school systems are doing is saying, how can we take some well-established, pretty old technologies and use them to kind of do the things that we were doing before that met all of these different criteria? So the two most widely used technologies of the pandemic have been learning management systems, things like Google Classroom or Schoolology or Canvas, that basically let you pass documents back and forth. And these were, you know, developed in the 1990s and made open source in the 2000s. And then the other major technology is one that when it was introduced in the 1930s was called video telephony, which we now call video conferencing. But it's, Zoom and Microsoft Teams and Google Meet. And these two technologies, which basically let us reproduce the forms of school as best we can at a distance, have been much more popular than anything that tries to reconfigure or transform the ways that school works.
Is that from a failure of imagination from school officials, or do the tools just are not ready for prime time yet?
Evangelists like to describe them as, I haven't found the right metaphor for this, but like bulldozers or like Swiss Army knives. They're going to sweep away the past, or they're going to let us do everything differently. But in fact, many of our learning technologies, they're more like pegs that are shaped for very specific holes. So we have a group of adaptive tutors that exist. These are computer tools that we've been developing since we've had computers, since the 1960s, where students see some kind of instructional material, they're given some kind of instructional question, they provide a response, and then the computer looks at their response, and if the response is correct, it moves them along the pathway to some different or more challenging material, and if it's incorrect, it gives them new kinds of pathways to explore. These tools depend upon autograders, sort of computational tools to evaluate human performance. It turns out that we have autograders that are good in some domains and not so good in others. We have some pretty good ones in mathematics, where there are really concrete right or wrong answers. We have some neat ones that are evolving in early language acquisition, which can detect using machine learning whether or not you've pronounced a word correctly. But we don't have good ones in lots of other things that we're trying to teach students. We still don't have good tools to evaluate whether or not students are writing effectively and persuasively and reasoning from evidence. Kind of the main thing that we do in our liberal arts education is teach kids how to reason from evidence. And we don't have good automated tools to do that, so we don't have good adaptive tutors to be able to teach those parts of the subject area. So, when we think about introducing new tools, let's think about, how could we create artificially intelligent tutors that teach our students? Well, we have only figured out how to use them in a few different slots in our educational system. And so I think there are some savvy, school systems that are starting to slot those in. I think we're seeing widespread use, for instance, in elementary schools, these kind of gamified adaptive math learning systems like Dreambox or ST Math or other kinds of things. And that's great, but it doesn't solve the problem of how to help a kid learn how to tie their shoes or be friends with one another or make sound letter mappings or learn about Oklahoma history or any of the other dozens of students to do in elementary school.
It's interesting because school reform experts say those are the skills we need our schools to be teaching, the critical thinking skills, the reasoning from evidence. And yet our technological tools are more geared for, if you will, binary question answers. It's either yes, no, it's...
There's a chapter in the book which is called The Trap of Routine Assessment, which lays out the problem just as you described it, which is that our autograders are good at testing things computers are good at, and things that our computers are good at we don't need humans to do anymore. There are other kinds of technology tools which are great for teaching these other kinds of things. So for just about any subject that you might want to learn, there are communities out there that are excited to teach and learn about that subject. If you want to know about the Civil War, the internet is full of people who are discussing the Civil War, sharing resources about the Civil War. All along the East Coast and Midwest, there are historical institutions and universities that have created archives of primary sources about these topics and so forth. But these things aren't tools in the same way that an adaptive tutor is a tool that you can sort of download onto a child's computer and say, click this and do this for the next half hour. taking advantage of these other online resources requires whole communities developing all kinds of new online skills. There's an online course that I'm teaching right now. I'm not just an education technology critic, but I also build some of this stuff. So we have a course that we're offering called Sorting Truth from Fiction, Civic Online Reasoning, where we're trying to teach people effective strategies for sorting truth from fiction online that are used by folks like fact checkers at national news magazines and things like that. And this is just like one particular skill that is not impossibly difficult, but takes folks some hours to learn and practice and get good at. And, you know, one of the main arguments in the book is that making technology work effectively in schools, it's not like flipping a switch. It's not just something that we slide in front of teachers and students and they go, oh, this is easy, now I'm going to learn better. The most ambitious, effective uses of technology in schools take a lot of learning for teachers, for administrators, for students, for families, to figure out how to use these tools effectively and well, and to create opportunities for the kind of problem solving and critical thinking that you're describing.
My guest today is Justin Reich. He's a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT, and is the author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in your book, Failure to Disrupt, you talk about a number of things, the algorithm-guided learning, which is what we've sort of been talking about in our conversation, and you sort of alluded to maybe peer-guided learning, where you learn about the Civil War through a peer group. But let's talk about massive open online courses. This was supposed to be transformative, especially for higher education. You know, everybody could enroll on these massive open online courses, and some of them are going to be even free or a fraction of cost of traditional college. How has that worked out?
Enrollments in massive open online courses have grown every year since 2012 as a whole field, and they haven't had the profound transformative effect in higher education or access to higher education that folks promised they would. And the way I would describe it is that the higher education system did with MOOCs what it does with nearly all other technologies, except those it completely rejects, which is to domesticate them, to find some particular place within the complex landscape of higher education where these MOOCs could prove to be useful. You know, if the education technology evangelists want us to think that new technologies can disrupt educational systems, it's often better to think that they domesticate these new kinds of technologies. So the way that they domesticate them is to find particular niches where they might be useful. And so in this case, it turned out that these tools were particularly good for learners who are already good at learning. It turns out that self-paced, independently guided online learning is really hard for most learners. But the way you get good at informal learning is through an apprenticeship with the formal education system. So MOOCs have mostly turned to serve people in professional degree programs, particularly in things that are convenient to teach online because professionals do them online. So they seem to work for teaching computer science and data science and accounting and other kinds of things that you would do in front of a computer, where we've seen less progress in using them to teach writing or nursing or teaching or other things that require a lot of human interaction. So again, you know, sort of as a default, you might say, as there are new technologies, new education technologies coming along the line, the next time that someone tells us that it's going to be artificial intelligence or big data or virtual reality that's poised to transform education, we can say, well, that might have happened, but it really hasn't happened before. And the most likely thing to anticipate is that there's going to be some way that these new technologies are sort of brought into the existing system and find a particular home there, rather than, you know, reinventing or reshaping the whole landscape.
I want to get into the unequal benefits from technology. I mean, this is one of the big issues in our current distance learning, is that for some learners, and especially the ones that you talked about that might benefit from MOOCs, they may get great benefits from that technology. It may be very unequal across a whole range of spectrums.
Sure. So one of the arguments that education technologists often make is that new technologies have the possibility to democratize education. This is actually one of the oldest arguments in education technology. My colleague Larry Cuban, who's a historian at Stanford University, has a book that he published some years ago called Teachers and Machines, where one of the subjects he talks about is radio and how school systems incorporated radio into their practices. And there's a photo in the book of a bunch of kids standing around a radio receiver that's the size of a small child. And the caption says, with radio, the underprivileged school becomes the privileged one. And the idea is that we'll be able to, you know, beam the best quality radio content from homes into, from elite institutions into homes and schools. And then, you know, poverty-impacted students will have the same resources that affluent students do. And as, you know, most of us experienced over the last century, radio did not close achievement and opportunity gaps in our country.
Neither did television.
Neither did a home computer. None of those things. So affluent people have the financial, social, and technical capital to take advantage of new innovations, even if they're free. And it's not going to be new technologies that change the yawning inequalities that we see even more clearly after the pandemic. It's going to be social movements and communities of people. If we want there to be less inequalities in our schools, then we have to think about how we fund them, how we support poverty-impacted families, how we support families in our most rural neighborhoods and our urban centers. And, you know, it's not that technology could have no role to play in that, but it's going to be a bit player compared with the other kinds of things that we want to do. You know, by some estimates, there are 15 million out of the 57 million kids in the United States right now that don't have an adequate internet connection to participate in remote and distance learning. The odds that a poverty-impacted family is one of those 15 million is much, much higher than the odds of an affluent family. And even when those students can connect, you know, one of the things people think of the digital divide often as an issue of access, like who has stuff and who doesn't. But there's also lots of research that says people from different backgrounds use technology differently or are given opportunities to use technology differently. One of the things that I'm most concerned about during the pandemic is I think there's very good reason to believe that teachers are going to police students' behavior on Zooms. I think people have seen all these kinds of rules of you're not allowed to eat, you have to wear certain things, you have to keep your camera on, you have to, you know, you can't be in your bedroom, you have to be in a public space even if you don't have anywhere to work other than a bedroom. And my hunch is that all of that policing and sanctioning will be more severe for Black students, for Latino students, for Native American students than it is for white students, because we see that in every other form of discipline that we mete out in schools. And so even if tomorrow you gave every kid in America a broadband connection and every kid in America a laptop, it doesn't mean that students would have equitable experiences in learning through those connections, because our social and cultural exclusions are as powerful and as problematic as our technological exclusions.
And it sounds like one of your messages is that we tend to use technology as the cheap alternative of doing the really hard work in education, in transforming education and transforming educational opportunity.
I think that's right. And the twist that I would maybe put on it is that I do think technologies do two things that are important here. One is they catalyze conversations in ways that make people more willing and excited to talk about them. We're in some respects, we're seeing right now the same inequalities during the pandemic that we've seen in our system for, you know, 100 plus years. But these yawning gaps in access are really noticeable to people. They spark the conversation in new ways, just like the availability of these technologies for teaching and learning is also sparking new kinds of conversations. There are ways that teachers during this period are saying, hey, lots of this is hard, but there are some things that we're doing that seem to be working, and how could we incorporate them into new practice? So one is technology is a place to catalyze these conversations. And then the second is that the demand for learning, the need for more learning opportunities in our society is vast. And it's really hard to imagine in a world of 8 billion people how we would meet all of the hopes and dreams and aspirations of learners at all levels in all different parts of the world if we can't find better ways of using education technology to expand these kinds of opportunities.
All right. Justin Reich, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much for having me.
Justin Reich is a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT. His book is titled Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. It's published by Harvard University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.